there. My name is Bill Curry, and this is a podcast version of a talk I gave at the SEG meeting in 2006 in New Orleans, Louisiana. The title of this talk was Interpolating Diffracted Multiples with Prediction Error Filters. So to start off, I just want to motivate this talk and ask the question, of course, why are we doing this? And diffraction multiples are becoming increasingly problematic, or have always been problematic, I guess, but especially in the cross-line direction. In terms of when we do an offshore 3D marine survey, these cross-line diffracted multiples can pose quite a problem. And it's for many reasons. They have a shifted apex. They existing methods don't do too well in terms of trying to remove these at the near offsets, a few other things. And so one of the common ways to deal with this issue in 2D is SRME, surface-related multiple elimination. Which usually works very well when our underlying geology is 2D and for a 2D acquisition. However, in 3D, there's some issues with using this 3D SRME, and that is that it requires a very dense and regular sampling. So essentially what it relies on is an autoconvolution of the data with itself, and so you need to have essentially a source point everywhere. You have a receiver and things nice and densely sampled and not aliased in both the inline direction, which isn't a big deal, and the cross-line direction, which is a big deal, because we don't sample along a nice straight cable. We just have basically point measurements in terms of where each receiver cable is and where each sail line is and where the flip and flop shooting is and things like that. So much sparser acquisition leads to this problem in 3D. So to just outline what I'm going to talk about during this podcast, first of all, I'll go into the general theory in terms of how we interpolate using prediction error filters, in this case non-stationary prediction error filters, how we interpolate it in terms of a two-stage process. We first gather information about our data using the prediction error filter, and then using that information contained in the prediction error filter to interpolate our missing data. Once I go over that, which will be the bulk of the talk, then I'll talk about the data set in question, which I'm going to interpolate both flip-flop results, so interpolate missing shots as well as missing receiver cables. And this first result is in the inline, and we can see how we can get away with using a much cheaper interpolation method, whereas in the cross line we'll see when trying to interpolate receiver cables how we need to use things that are a bit more sophisticated in terms of computational complexity and memory requirements and things like that. So starting off with how to interpolate using prediction error filters. So we can phrase interpolation basically as a series of two steps, and there are certainly other ways to do this, but many ways can sort of be broken down into this way of thinking. And the first step of which is gather some information about what data you have. In this case, I would talk about estimating a prediction error filter. In other cases, in terms of polynomial interpolation, it could be estimating your polynomial coefficients. If you think about a transform-based method, Fourier or a radon-based, it's typically viewed as your forward transform into Fourier space or into the radon space, so that space contains the information that you want. Then once we've done this transform or get this information, in my case, we use that knowledge to fill the hole. So we use a second least squares problem where we use our prediction error filter to constrain the missing data. In other methods, it would be for polynomials, it would be evaluating that polynomial at a certain location. In the transform-based methods, it would be the inverse transform, essentially. So that's basically the two-stage method of doing it. If you think about that, that could be a big part of a larger nonlinear scheme where you can start to estimate a prediction error filter on data you've interpolated and go forward like that. But let's just look at the linear case because it's much more stable and it actually works quite well. So the first step of which I was mentioning is estimating a prediction error filter. And the equation I'm showing here is just a few matrices, and it's just the convolution of data. We can see we have a 7-point data vector here with a 3-term filter. We can see is F, and two of those filter coefficients are unknown. The first filter coefficient is constrained to be 1, and this is a prediction error filter. It's something that when convolved with our data will ideally minimize it. It will destroy it. It will filter any error in prediction, if you will, because it has the leading one in there. And one more reason why it would have this leading one is that if we simply had all coefficients being free to be anything, you'd typically wind up with a trivial solution of all filter coefficients being zero, minimizing this. So what we have here, again, to go over this, is a data vector being convolved with an unknown filter where the first filter coefficient is constrained to be 1. And that's why we have the diagonal matrix with the 0, 1, 1, as well as the extra data vectors. That's just the algebra associated with constraining that first filter coefficient to be 1. But you can see here on the left part of this equation, it says 0 is sort of kind of equal to r, which is our residual, which is equal to this. And essentially what I'm saying here is that we're solving this as a least squares problem, is that we're solving this system of equations for our two unknowns, F1 and F2, our two unknown filter coefficients in this case. So it's the least squares problem where we minimize convolution of data with our filter, put into words. And so by doing this, we'll capture information about our data in this prediction error filter. So we can write this then in terms of matrices and simplify things a bit and omit the implementation details here by just saying that we have a minimization problem where we minimize the residual of our data convolved with our unknown filter, and we try and find an F a filter that minimizes this. So we can see we're using an L2 norm here, and there's also a weight, and I'll get into this weight in a bit. This is a diagonal weight for missing data, because if you think about it, we're trying to interpolate missing data, we're estimating a prediction error filter on what data we have, so clearly we're going to have to play a trick here, and I'll get into that in a bit. Before I get into that, I'd just like to state that the example I showed is clearly for a one-dimensional case. A prediction error filter is not limited to that. It can be n-dimensional, and the prediction error filters I will be talking about here will actually be in time and space. It will be in tx. Actually, this will be talking about t source x, t receiver x, t receiver, cross-line receiver spacing. It'll be working along these different dimensions. And in terms of how we implement this, you can take a look on the right of this slide and see that the first filter I'm showing here, a five-term filter, is a simple one-dimensional filter. Next to that, I'm showing actually it is a two-dimensional filter, but if you look at the subscript on the filter coefficients, you can see we just have one subscript. And we can actually implement things this way using this helix coordinate, which is a idea of Chant Clairbout's back in the late 90s. And you can see here that this this is a way to do a two-dimensional filter. You can divide by this filter and do all sorts of things and treat it like a one-dimensional problem. This also extends to higher dimensions as well. I'll be using three-dimensional filters for a portion of this talk. I've also used four-dimensional filters. It just basically keeps going up until you run out of memory. So the idea of these filters are multidimensional, and unlike the traditional prediction error filter-based method, this is not in FX. This is in 2D in TX and in TXY, just to make sure that's clear. And the other thing I want to talk about before getting back towards the weighting and the issues with trying to interpolate or trying to estimate a filter on data that we want to interpolate is this idea of non-stationarity. And the top portion of the slide here has an image that looks sort of stationary in terms of, you can see it has essentially one dominant dip. The frequency content is roughly similar throughout it. And so this is something that we could deal with a single stationary prediction error filter. If we look at the image in the bottom, we see something, and it's actually three sections of a cube, and you'll see many of these plots in this talk, where the top portion is a depth slice through where the yellow line is on the other two panels. The rightmost section corresponds to a slice going in and out of the cube in terms of how you're looking at it, and that corresponds to the yellow line being shown in the other two panels on the left, and then finally the front face corresponds to a simple cross section along the lines that you can see in both the depth slice and the slice going in and out of the plane of the screen. So this is essentially an unfolded cube, and we're showing slices from inside that cube. What you can see here is this is an anticline structure, and you can see here that the dips are not constant in space, is that they vary, there's lots of curvature, there's dips that truncate against from one another, you know, corresponding to something like a unconformity or something like that. So the idea with this bottom image is this synthetic example is something much closer to what we see in terms of seismic data, with lots of hyperbolas everywhere. So here is something much more realistic in terms of what we have to deal with. And so the way typically people deal with this is in two different ways. The first way is to break the problem up into stationary regions. So they take a small chunk of what we see in the bottom and hope that it looks like the top image, where the dip stays roughly constant. Do our interpolation, do your transform, do your entire procedure and output the interpolated data from this little chunk, and do this for a whole bunch of little chunks that overlap, and then stitch them up back together. And that's sort of a patchwork type implementation, windowing or patchwork type method. Another way to do it, which is how I'm doing it today, is if we deal with everything at once using non-stationary filters. And so we just estimate a filter that varies in space that can account for dips changing as a function of space and a function of time, and the spectrum varying as a function of space and a function of time, and use that. And that's what I'll be talking about next here. And I'll start off with actually just showing a stationary convolution with a stationary filter, and then I'm going to show a non-stationary convolution with a non-stationary filter. So here we have a simple four-term filter that's being convolved with 10 data points. So we can see that our output, where we have the filter lying on the data, corresponds to 7 points. So we can see here that we just march our filter along. If we look at the system of equations that forms on the right, we get something that looks pretty straightforward. We have, in this case, 7 equations corresponding to the 7 output points, and we have 3 unknowns, A, B, and C. So when estimating a stationary prediction error filter, it is a nice unique solution to least squares problem, where we have more equations than we do unknowns. And so that makes things nice and straightforward in the stationary case. Next, I'm going to show you what a non-stationary filter looks like and the issue with this. Here I've got a non-stationary filter that has a subscript, and this is a filter that varies in position. We can see as we march it along, we now have the same 7 equations, but we can see instead of having 3 unknowns, we now have 29 unknowns. So if we now take, 21 unknowns. And so if we take these two series of equations and put them side by side, we can see here that the top one we have something that's overdetermined, and the bottom one we have something that's underdetermined. So the problem with this nice non-stationary method that can account for spatial variability in terms of what we're trying to interpolate is that we go from being overdetermined with a nice unique solution and lots of theory behind that to an underdetermined solution where we have many possible solutions to this, and we have a null space, and so we have to add a regularization term in order to make this a well-posed system of equations. And so going back to our previous notation, we can take our data convolved with our unknown non-stationary filter this time, which you can see is in the leftmost term, again weighted by missing data, which I'll get into next. And we have to add a second regularization term with an epsilon, which is sort of a knob telling us how much regularization we want. We have to have our filter that's being regularized next. And this regularization operator is actually a Laplacian filter that smooths over space. So it just ensures that things are spatially smooth. And it operates over common filter coefficients is the idea. So it just does one filter coefficient at a time and makes sure that it's smooth. It's basically a second derivative. And so by putting these two things together, we can then get a smoothly non-stationary prediction error filter. So once we get this prediction error filter, be it stationary or non-stationary, we can use it in a second least squares problem, which I'm showing here. I'm not going to talk too much about this because in terms of how we do this, it's relatively straightforward. Is here we have a second least squares problem with regularization again, you can see, because of that epsilon in that second term. But the first term here says that we will honor our original data, that our output model, our interpolated result, will match our data where we have data. That's just minimizing M minus D. What the second term says is that we're going to minimize the convolution of our prediction error filter with this unknown model. And so if you picture a filter being convolved with something with a rough edge, say where your data is honored and then you have a bunch of zeros, well, that filter will most likely continue that event along. And so the idea with convolving with a prediction error filter will be that it actually continues our known data into regions that we have missing data. So if we getting onto this weight now, if we look at just interpolating by a factor of 2, here I show a bunch of stripes that are yellow that correspond to where we have recorded data, and the background color would correspond to missing data. So we want to interpolate by a factor of 2. Here we have a two-dimensional prediction error filter in both space and time. And if we look here, any point where we try to convolve our filter with this data to actually estimate this filter, we're going to see that we have filter coefficients that fall on data that we don't know. So we're kind of caught in this catch-22 that we want to capture information about our data, but we don't have that data we want to capture information about. So if we look back to that weight, what that weight is going to be is anywhere where we have a filter coefficient of our prediction error filter falling on data that we don't know, we set this weight equal to 0. And so if you look at this example, no matter where we put our prediction error filter, we're going to be dealing with missing data. So we're going to have W being equal to 0 everywhere. So we cannot estimate a prediction error filter in this case. So here comes the trick. This is where we have to make an assumption and hope that it's right. And here's what that assumption is. So we're essentially just spacing the filter out. And if we do that, we can see that if we just skip every other trace and every other time sample, we can get a weight equals to 1, so a valid fitting equation at many points throughout this and actually estimate something. But the assumption here that we're making is that this spaced out filter, when we convolve it, gives us a result that's roughly equal to this. And so we have issues in terms of if we are time sampled poorly, which thankfully we're not, we're going to run into issues. So we certainly hope that we're oversampled by a factor of 2 in terms of time. So we probably have to, we should filter a bit beforehand to try and eliminate that. And also we'd be worried a bit about things that are frequency dispersive in terms of things that when viewed at this coarser scale have a different dip or different move out than they do at this previous finer scale. So those are some of the issues with this. But if we look at it for many cases, and in this case I'm going to show it works actually quite well. But for if you're dealing with ground roll and things like that, spreading this filter out is probably not the best idea. So now that I've talked about how to interpolate using prediction error filters in this two-stage method, where we first estimate a non-stationary prediction error filter by spacing these filter coefficients out, so that's our big assumption, then squeezing the filter back together and using that in a second least squares problem to constrain the missing data. That's essentially the method. So now that I've gone over that, I'm going to talk about the data set in question, which was donated by ExxonMobil, a synthetic data set here. And what it is, it's a whole bunch of point diffractors right below a water bottom, where these point diffractors come into play right where we have reflectors that we're interested in. And so it's we can see here in terms of the schematic, that's coupled with a nice modern acquisition and with the hope of performing 3D SRME on it. So if we look a bit more in detail at this acquisition geometry, we've got it's a very dense sampling in terms of inline receivers at 12.5 meters, which is our goal in all other dimensions as a result of that. Our inline shot spacing, looking at just the flips or just the flops, is about 37.5 meters, so 3 times receiver spacing. Receiver cable spacing, we'd need to worry about a 4-time upsample and interpolation. Sail lines is the big one, where we'd have to worry about a factor of 16, going from 200 meters to 12.5 meters. If we're able to introduce or first interpolate missing flips and missing flops, we'd then have two sources side by side, which would then go down to a factor of 8. But the things I'm going to talk about today are the shot interpolation and the receiver cable interpolation. So shots in the inline and receiver cables in the cross line. So to first talk about the flip-flop interpolation results. Here we have what I call a common receiver gather that essentially will look like a common offset section for this data. Well, we can see this is a factor of 2. We can see our water bottom reflection. Below that we see all these point diffractors. Then down around 5 seconds here, we can see the water bottom multiple. Immediately before, below that we see two reflectors of interest. And we see these big clouds of diffracted multiples. Now, if we just use a two-dimensional prediction error filter here, so a very cheap method, just a TX, or in this case, time and source position based filter, we get something that looks like this. And we can see here it looks really good, except maybe at the far dips. We can see where at the far edge, we can sort of see where this steeply dipping stuff might be breaking some of our assumptions. If you use a three-dimensional prediction error filter, so in terms of using both source position, we also use receiver position. So we also work along the cable. So if you picture this being a three-dimensional cube, we aren't just moving in terms of the source along. We also have a receiver cable, which we can estimate a prediction error filter on. So we now would have a three-dimensional prediction error filter in source position, receiver cable, along the receiver cable, and in time. And if we do that, which is quite a bit more expensive, you can see that we clean that up. But it's really quite minor in the grand scheme of things. So the thing to take out of this is that this test, just going up by a factor of 2 in terms of sources, actually isn't too bad. One thing where it gets interesting is we can see where our assumption breaks down. If we think of a factor of 3, where we'd wind up spacing out our filter instead of just interleaving it in terms of having a filter coefficient, a blank space, and then another filter coefficient. Factor of 3 would be a filter coefficient, 2 blank filter coefficients, and then a third. And if our frequency and if our sampling in time isn't that good, we can see what happens here with a factor of 3. And you can see it doesn't look too good. Clearly some things are aliased. We have some issues. What's interesting, though, is if we go with a different set of assumptions, instead of spacing our filter out by a factor of 3, we actually interpolate by a factor of 4, and we interpolate by a factor of 4 by first interpolating by a factor of 2, and then using that as input to interpolate again by a factor of 2, so sort of making it a nonlinear problem and relinearizing, essentially assuming that our interpolated data is as good as our original data. You can see that we go from a fairly poor-looking factor of 3 and change our assumptions, do this sort of repeat the interpolation procedure twice, we get a much nicer result and actually with denser sampling. So I thought that was sort of an interesting point in terms of dealing with these assumptions, how it's very important which one you pick, and that's largely the key to this. And here we see a very obvious example of that. So now that I showed flip-flop interpolation, let me just summarize what I was talking about here. And the main point of this is that the dimensionality of the filters doesn't have that big of an impact in terms of the factor of 2. We can see you can get by doing something quite cheap. The other thing here was in terms of what assumption you're making. And this type of interpolation method works quite good for a factor of 2 because our data generally lives up to those assumptions that we're making. However, the factor of 3 certainly doesn't work very well. But a factor of 4, by doing a slightly different set of assumptions, actually works very well. So it's sort of an important point to bring up. Finally, I'm going to talk about receiver cable interpolation and getting more towards the current problem. Here I'm going to show a single shot from this survey, and you can see there's 12 receiver cables. And here I'm just using a simple two-dimensional interpolation. And a few things to look at here. Again, here I'm showing a three-dimensional cube. But the 2D interpolation is actually the axes involved are, this is in time and in cross-line offset. So for each trace you see on the front panel, a two-dimensional filter has interpolated in the cross-line only. And you can see here there's some fairly poor results. We aren't waiting or anything, and so if we're dealing with an L2 norm, it's going to go with the most energetic arrivals first in terms of where it puts its effort in terms of estimating the prediction error filter and actually interpolating. And so you can see it's not interpolating the water. I believe it's the water bottom multiple. You can see in the depth slice how it sort of looks like a checkerboard. And anywhere place where you see the sort of checkerboard pattern, which is quite common here, you can see that our interpolated data is not looking like the neighboring data. But some of the diffractions, it's getting quite well, but it's actually missing some of the more easily predictable stuff because it's weaker in energy. If we move up to a 3D interpolation, you can see that things smooth out substantially, and that our filter is able to capture more information about our data, gain a more sophisticated knowledge of what's in that data to capture more dips, to capture more of the spectrum, and to whiten the output more. So you can see here when we interpolate from 2D to 3D, it's quite a difference in terms of things look more energetic, and at the near offsets, it looks like there's actually more complexity to the interpolated result. The next thing I'm going to show is interpolating by a factor of 4. And this is, again, done by first interpolating by a factor of 2 and then taking that as input and interpolating again. And you can see that this problem gets even more pronounced when just using a simple 2D prediction error filter in the cross line. You can actually see the checkerboard getting even more interesting, where you can see the first generation of data was interpolated and it doesn't match the original, and then you can see where the second generation was interpolated and it's even worse. So you see even more of the striping. Again, in 3D, you can see how it's a much nicer, cleaner result, and it's much more difficult to tell what data was acquired and what data wasn't. So going back, you can see here that the difference is, especially when doing this sort of factor of 2 followed by factor of 2 followed by factor of 2, which is necessary for these large amounts, you can see that using a more sophisticated interpolation, you're losing less with each successive factor of 2. We can then look at in terms of 12 cables dropping to 6 cables, something that's closer to more of a spec survey where we still have issues, but even worse sampling in the cross-line direction. And you can see here for a factor of 4, we still get a pretty good result. There's certainly a bit of checkerboarding, but not quite so bad. You can compare it to having an original input of 12 cables, and it's certainly different, but the 6 cables isn't quite as horrible as you'd expect. It's actually not as bad as the how sophisticated of a prediction error filter using, three-dimensional versus two-dimensional, which I thought was an interesting point. So to conclude, inline interpolation is relatively insensitive to the complexity of the prediction error filter used, the size of the prediction error filter, which links directly to the expense and memory and all that sort of stuff. So in terms of the inline, it's not a big surprise that that's not a huge issue. The cross lines where things get interesting. However, one point to note is that interpolating by a factor of 4 in terms of this prediction error filter-based method, or going up by factors of 2, is a much safer set of assumptions than trying to interpolate initially by a larger factor, by, say, a factor of 3. Then in terms of the receiver cable interpolation, it's quite sensitive to what dimensionality the filters you're using, and it's improved substantially. But as we saw in the final example, nothing can replace acquiring denser data. And as we're seeing with the rich azimuth and all this other sort of stuff coming out, there's much more, many people are taking that viewpoint, and I can certainly see why. So in terms of future work, we can go to four-dimensional filters, and the results are not as drastic as going from 2D to 3D, but it does help. There are some issues in terms of being much, much more expensive and greater edge effects, because you have one more dimension of edge effects to worry about. The big thing here is dealing with real geometry and real sail lines and real data, so dealing with issues like cable feathering and things like that, and also phrasing the quality output in terms of the output of 3D SRME, which is more than likely what this type of work will be used for as an eventual goal. For acknowledgments, I'd like to thank Anatoly Baumstein and Dave Hinckley at ExxonMobil for the data and for many useful discussions when I was there as an intern in 2005. Thank you very much.